bottle of white, a bottle of red, perhaps a bottle of rosé instead.
For some, drinking a glass of wine is a way to wind down after a long day, or something to sip and savor at a celebration. For others, it's a quest in search of flavor. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We are going to talk with an author about her journey into the world of sommeliers to figure out what's so special about wine. We will also learn about how everyone, not just professionals, can learn how to improve the sense of taste and smell through wine. We'll wonder if you have a favorite wine, be it an expensive vintage or some fruity Wisconsin wine. What's the best, least expensive wine that you've ever enjoyed? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Bianca Bosker, a journalist who has written about food, wine, architecture, and technology for a number of publications. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Cork Dork, a wine-fueled adventure among the obsessive sommeliers, big bottle hunters, and rogue scientists who taught me to live for taste. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks a lot for being with us. Well, before we dive into your journey in the world of wine, you were a technology reporter. What led you to your wine epiphany?
So I was not only a tech reporter before all of this, but I was a total wine ignoramus.
Mm-hmm.
I was not a wine connoisseur. I mean, it was a nice thing to enjoy at dinner, but didn't really see what the fuss was about. And I was sort of surprised as anyone else when I embarked on this journey. And what started it was I discovered this world of Cork Dork. And Cork Dork isn't just the name of the book. It's also the restaurant industry's nickname for the most passionate and obsessed and knowledgeable wine lovers among them. And I think that we think of wine as being this thing of pleasure, and these Cork Dorks, these sommeliers, these collectors, turn it into something of sheer all-out pain. They lick rocks to train their palates. They divorce their spouses to spend more time studying. They compete in these competitions that are like the Westminster dog show with booze. Hire voice coaches, memory coaches. They take dance lessons to learn how to move more gracefully across the floor. And I was fascinated, first of all, because I didn't get it. You know, I just felt like, what was the big deal about wine? Why would people turn their lives upside down, spend all this time and money on something that at the end of the day turns into, you know, expensive pee? and secondly, on a personal level, because I was covering tech at that point, you know, these psalms made me realize how sterile my life was. You know, I spent almost all day, every day at screens, writing about things that happened on screens, and here was this subculture dedicated to these physical pleasures of taste and smell. And they could pick up stories in odors and acid that I couldn't even begin to fathom. And so I got fixated on this question of, could I do it? Could I become one of them? And so it turned into not just writing about Cork Dorks, but I set out to see if I could become one of them. So I quit my job, got a job as a cellar rat, and started over at the very bottom to train as a sommelier.
All right, so I got to get some definitions here. What is a cellar rat?
So cellar rat is the lowest of the low in the wine world. It is a job that is every bit as glamorous as it sounds. And it's basically, I was in charge of just taking receipt of hundreds of bottles of wine, figuring out where to put them, putting my life on the line, carrying full cases of wine up and down ladders. And it's also, more importantly, you know, sommeliers, as I discovered, they have a name for people, you know, the kind of amateurs. They are civilians. And that should give you some idea of the line that exists. And I realized very quickly that if I wanted to get into this world, I had to really turn my life upside down. I had to, you know, get in there, get a job, show I was serious, and really, knowing nothing, start at the very bottom.
Yeah, and what exactly is the sommelier?
So a sommelier is the person who, at the most basic level, is in charge of buying wine for a restaurant and selling it to the guests who come in. Now, I don't think that really does it justice. You know, sommeliers have had a not great reputation. You know, that we think of them as like the stodgy undertakers of the restaurant that, you know, go around and give you, you know, make you feel bad for not spending enough money on wine. I think that's a really outdated stereotype. This new generation has changed. And more than that, they're not just cork pullers, but they are creators in their own right. I mean, I was stunned. I mean, you think about it, there's these competitions that happen all over the world for sommeliers. And I didn't, I was like, you know what, you open a bottle, you pour it, and you're done, right? Where's the competitive aspect here? But in fact, sommeliers are actually sort of the ballerinas or Olympic gymnasts in some ways, where it looks deceptively easy, but there's this beauty that exists in elegance under pressure. I mean, they think about the word choice, where they put their hands on the bottle, how they move around the table. There's hundreds of pieces of etiquette dictating the proper form, and it's really about creating, not just delivering fermented grape juice to someone, but helping the good ones know that they can help create an emotional experience from the meal. And that's partially why, I mean, I will say some of them, you know, they're watching you more than you're watching them. They are analyzing you for cues about, is this a business dinner? Is it a date? You know, how many carats is that ring? What's the designer bag? I mean, all these things, yeah, it's about gauging the budget, but it's also, again, about understanding what is the emotional experience that you deliver.
Yeah. Well, I know it's got to differ from person to person, but why, as a profession, are there so many, as you put it in the subtitle, obsessive cork dorks?
So it is, I mean, all my life as a journalist, I think, you know, I've written about everything from teen celebrities to people who fall in love with video game characters. And I realized for me that uniting it is the fact that I've always been obsessed with obsession. And you're right, no one does mania like wine lovers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's different for every person what pulls them in. I mean, I will say that I was very keen, you know, there's a lot of books about making wine, right? This journey from grape to glass. And I was more interested in the consumption of wine, the appreciation of wine, this journey from glass to gullet. And so for sommeliers, for them, what brings them to a glass of wine, you know, is that they feel like their spirit is moved by the flavors in fermented grapes, the way that others feel their spirit moved by a painting or a piece of music or, you know, seeing a beautiful landscape. And for the collectors, it can be complicated. I mean, I went to one of the most extravagant wine collector gatherings on the planet. It's kind of this weird wine orgy. It's a celebration of the wines of Burgundy. And it was sort of horrifying because allegedly everyone was there to appreciate these, you know, very expensive wines, and they just guzzled them to no end. And I think you didn't even stop to savor what might be the best bottle you'd otherwise have all year. And then I think you have to think, well, wine is also about identity. It's partially why the battles are so fierce, is that people, you know, see themselves in a bottle of wine. It can be about the entry that they get into a particular class or circle.
I wanted you to back up just a little bit and talk about some of these practices or habits of the sommeliers, the obsessive whatever. What you said that they would do things to make sure that their palate was the best, or
yeah. Absolutely. So, well, to give you a sense, I not only quit my job, but where I would have been showing up, you know, 9 a.m. most weekday mornings, sitting down for an editorial meeting as my job as tech editor, Now in my new life as a cellar rat and aspiring sommelier, I was sitting down to my first 6 to 12 glasses of wine most weekday mornings around 10 a.m.
Wait, 6 to 12 before 10 a.m.?
Yeah, hungover by 2:30 p.m. And it was all part of this regime to learn how to savor and cultivate the really forgotten senses of taste and smell. So interestingly, as research this, you know, Plato and Aristotle decided early on that taste and smell didn't matter. They're the animalistic senses. And interestingly, that view, more than a lot of us realize, has influenced science, culture, our everyday lives. I mean, we have five senses, and yet we basically ignore two of them. And sommeliers throw that logic on their head. And so their lives are, in many ways, oriented around flavor. So, yeah, it's the blind tastings of just practicing over and over with a glass of wine to try and figure out the nuances of the grapes. But I also, you know, gave up perfume, scented laundry detergent, mouthwash, brushing my teeth at certain times of the day, extra salt, spicy foods, hard alcohol, drinking anything above a lukewarm temperature. There's all of these rituals that are designed to help your palate be more receptive to the nuances of wine. I will say you don't have to do that. I mean, if you're just looking to enjoy, you know, the Sauvignon Blanc you have for dinner a little bit more, you don't have to give up, you know, salt and coffee the way that I did. But there are things that you can do to begin to really listen to these ignored senses.
And we'll talk some about that. I would have a hard time giving up salt and coffee, let me tell you. But we will welcome your questions for our guest, Bianca Bosker, who is the author of Cork Dork. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So are you a sommelier or do you know someone who is? Are you a cork dork in another way, perhaps? Do you plan vacations around wineries by any chance? Do you know what your next glass of wine will be? Do you have a favorite kind of wine? What is it and why? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. So, are you a fan of red wine? Or white wine, or something else? What is it and why? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you drink a glass of wine every night with dinner? Is it something that you do on a regular basis to wind down after a long day? Or is it something that you only do maybe during some kind of special celebration? We are talking about wine, and we are talking about our fascination with wine and how some people, it's more than a fascination, it's an obsession. Our guest is Bianca Bosker. She is a former reporter who became a sommelier. And we are talking about her journey. We're welcoming your questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Bianca Bosker is a journalist who has written about food, wine, architecture, technology, and is the author of this New York Times bestseller. Let's see, we have we have a number of callers and Facebook comments, but I wanted to talk a little bit more, Bianca, about while you were writing this book, you spent time with a Morgan Harris, an at the time aspiring master sommelier. Talk about the different levels of sommeliers. You aspire to be a master?
So there's no kind of particular course or license that you have to get in order to become a sommelier. It's traditionally existed sort of like an apprenticeship system. And in fact, the journey to become a sommelier can, in some cases, make law school look relatively cheap and relatively easy.
Wow.
It requires really many, many, many hours in the floor, on the restaurant. But not just that, it's thousands of flashcards. It's understanding, far-off wine regions and their peculiarities. But what I was doing is, I had this aspiration of actually working the floor as a sommelier. And to be candid, at the beginning, I had no business being anywhere near the floor of a restaurant as a sommelier. And I wanted to figure out how could I get a job? And so I decided to take the Court of Master Sommeliers Certified Sommelier Exam, which is sort of the gold standard for working the floor. And there are various levels. So there's an intro exam. You have to pass an exam before you can even take the certified exam. And it goes all the way up to the very top level is the Master Sommelier Exam. And my mentors, including Morgan, who is incredible, and one of those great obsessives who gets very excited about wine, was preparing for the Master Sommelier Exam. And there's a fail rate of around 90 to 95%.
Wow.
I mean, this test is impossible. People spend, a decade trying to pass it and never do. And so I was lucky to have these very senior somms taking an interest in me, although I will say that for my exam, it had recommended... For the certified exam, they recommend at least 3 years in the wine industry before you attempt to take it. And you can't, there's no course you can take. It's stuff you have to learn on your own on the floor. And I was giving myself not 3 years, but a year to take it. So it was extreme. It was very intense. And that's partially why I had to really turn my life upside down, but also, ended up not just training and working with sommeliers, but also with master perfumers, neuroscientists, anyone who would, in my mind, help me accelerate my chances.
Well, that's amazing. It really is. So what did you learn in general about wine from Morgan?
Oh, my gosh. What didn't I learn? I mean, I will say that there's what I learned is, on the whole, was that to get more out of wine, to savor wine, it's not just about what happens with your body, with taste and smell. Blind tasting is a deeply mental exercise. You're sitting in front of a glass of wine, and you don't know anything about it except for what's in the glass. And you have to figure out what year it was made, from what grapes, how and where, down to some tiny corner of the planet. Not a country, but think of a vineyard, the size of, Central Park. And when you're at that glass, there's so much, we're used to relying on so many external cues to tell us what we're experiencing. And when you're blind tasting, you have to clear that out. And what I learned from Morgan was that mental discipline. I think a lot of us, there's an irony. We're foodies, right? Everyone's obsessed with spending more money and time and effort on tracking down things that taste better, but we don't spend the time to teach ourselves to taste well. And so I think not just with wine, but with all kinds of things, we settle for secondhand sensing, right? Something is delicious because it's from a trendy restaurant or the branding was cool. And wine taught me how to filter out that noise and stay true to my own felt experience of something. And that's a mindset that I now reach to, not just when I'm drinking wine, but when I'm reading, when I'm editing my own writing, when I'm just going around my daily life. It's staying true to our own judgment.
So what will be your next glass of wine, Bianca? What would you want to have, at lunch today?
So I have recently gotten very into wines from Slovenia, which is, you know, a teeny tiny little country right between, you know, Italy, Croatia. And there's a great producer called Movia. But I will say that one of my good friends was visiting the other day, and we got into he's actually from Wisconsin, and we got into a long conversation about cheese curds, which are one of my favorite foods on the planet.
Good for you.
When I think about, you know, I was thinking about that, and I was like, you know, another favorite wine that I think would be delicious with cheese curds is a dry Riesling, which I think a lot of us, which I understand there's some great Rieslings coming up in Wisconsin,
yeah,
actually. But I think a lot of us assume that Riesling is sweet. It has a reputation as a sweet wine, and people don't always drink it for that reason. But it is. There are fantastic sweet examples, and there are fantastic examples that are not sweet, also known as dry, which I actually think is really masochistic because it's so confusing to have to describe a wet thing as dry.
Yeah.
I'm hungry and a little thirsty just thinking about it.
I love this. I think we have to start cheese, curds, and wine tastings.
I'm there.
That is great. Well, and the reason I ask that is that we do have a lot of people who are, you know, kind of chiming in on different types of wine that they like and or don't like. But I guess before we went to break, you talked about how those of us who aren't professionals might be able to and don't want to necessarily give up coffee and salt and everything else might be able to better appreciate the tastes of wine. Is there, I mean, what do you or did you look for when you were doing a wine tasting?
So, as I mentioned, I was really keen on this journey to, you know, not explore just the tradition and the romance around wine, which we hear a lot about, but to supplement that with the science, right, the history even. I think that, you know, there's a tendency in the wine world, you know, we hear the fairy tale a lot, and I was curious, but I was also a little skeptical of that. And so as part of my training, as I mentioned, I work not just with these sommeliers and the tried and true methods passed down through generations of wine lovers, but also with sensory scientists. And what I found is, well, first of all, when we think about appreciating wine, it doesn't just start with memorizing grape regions or grape varieties. No, it's starts with teaching yourself to pay attention to these neglected senses of taste and smell. And smell is really important. So, first of all, we have a tendency to confuse them. So we think that anything that happens in our mouth is taste, whereas, in fact, we can smell things in our mouth, and we also smell them, of course, with our nostrils. And we can perceive about 5 different tastes, whereas some scientists estimate that we can perceive around 1 trillion different odors. So when you think about picking up the nuances in a glass of wine, it starts really with the smell. And that's difficult because growing up, most of us never learn to listen to our noses. We never learn to put words on smells. And so, of course, if you don't know a lot about wine and someone like me comes over and starts raving about how something smells like dirt and peppered pomegranate and how that's a wonderful thing, you're going to think I'm full of it, and rightfully so. And so I think that really what it starts with is learning to build your sense memory. So smell everything. Smell a rose in your garden. Say the word rose. Try and describe it. Do what a master perfumer advised me to do. You know, in the morning when you're shampooing your hair, try and describe the smell of it. Describe the smell of your toothpaste at night. Take a smell of black pepper or parsley as you're throwing it into dinner at night. Say the words. Try and describe it. And all of that, it's really the same process as learning a new word or language, right? You're attaching meaning to not a sound in this case, but a smell. And it's through doing that that I think you'll begin to pick up on the nuances that exist between glasses of wine.
I like this assignment.
It's fun. It is really fun. And I think for me, I found that it has opened up my world way beyond a glass of wine. I think being able to pick up on smell, it provides not, you know, more information about our day-to-day lives. I live now in New York, and I can tell you that, you know, I can smell different subway stations even before I get there. There's a way that you can pick up on the heartbeat of the place that you live in. You know, driving into a city, you can smell the way that the environment changes as you get near people cooking their dinner, living out their lives. And there's a beauty. I mean, I think smell can also be an escape that's free and is around us all the time and is so pleasurable.
And so if we pick up on that and we appreciate that more, we might smell that, a fruit or some kind of smell in the wine, and that will help us taste it better?
Yeah, so there's, for example, there's definitely a, it's part of understanding the story in the wine. I mean, I can tell you that when I started it, I would stick my nose into a glass of wine, and on a really good day, I could tell you that I was smelling wine. And these cork dorks, these sommeliers, they could smell a glass of wine and tell stories from those smells, right? That it smelled like green bell pepper, it smelled like horses, it smelled like dirt. And those begin to be clues about where that wine came from, where it was made, how, all these things. And so I think that, yeah, it's you're never going to be able to smell the beauty of dirt or green bell pepper in a glass of wine if you don't know what dirt and green bell pepper smells like. And in fact, most of us don't.
Yeah, yeah.
We just never have learned.
We have some callers and others who want to share their favorite wines or have questions for you. We have an open line for you as well at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So how is wine a part of your life? And do you have a favorite Wisconsin wine? What do you drink with your cheese curds? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Bianca Bosker is our guest. She is the author of Cork Dork, a wine-fueled adventure among the obsessive sommeliers, big bottle hunters, and rogue scientists who taught me to live for taste. Let's go first to Casey in Milwaukee. Hi, Casey.
Hi.
Yes, what is your question?
Hey. Hi. So I am a huge fan of red wine. It's actually the only alcohol I drink. I don't like any other kind of alcoholic beverages. I'm also an Orthodox Jew, and wine is a very big part of our life. So every week, you know, we have the Sabbath, and we have wine with our meal. And it's a very important part of our lives. But I am kind of restricted then in the kind of wine that I can have because I can only have kosher wine.
Oh.
So I was wondering, what do you know about, have you experienced different kosher wines? Do you know, are there kosher sommeliers? And if you have had kosher wines, do you have a recommendation for a really good one that maybe I haven't tried?
That's a great question. So there are actually a lot of really fantastic kosher wines out there. One of my favorites is a winery in Israel that's fantastic. I think a lot of people, you know, don't realize this, but Israel as well as Lebanon, I had an interesting Turkish wine the other day. These are places where they've been making wine for a very long time. And it's a winery called Zora Vineyards, T-Z-O-R-A. And I used to serve it at this fantastic wine bar, Terroir, where I worked. And it was such a crowd pleaser. I mean, it is a blend of different red grapes, this one in particular, and it's from a region known as the Judean Hills. So I think that you're not limited by any means. You should be able to find it online somewhere. Who knows? But, you know, I think that there's the future is bright.
Are there kosher sommeliers out there? Is that a thing?
That I have no idea, to be honest. That's a great question. I mean, that seems like a great opportunity if there aren't already.
Yeah, Casey, there you go.
Maybe I'll look into it. If you're looking for a new career, I mean, there's a...
Thank you very much, Casey, for the call. Paul called in but couldn't stay with us. He wants to know if expensive wines are truly better than cheaper wines.
So that is a timeless question and a great one. And that was one that I also... struggled with, to be honest, because as I was learning to blind taste wines and pick up differences in, you know, Chenin Blanc from France versus Chenin Blanc from South Africa, I felt like I wasn't really learning to tell what made for a good wine. And this sent me on a hunt. And as part of the way of answering this question, I mean, I found that there was no, I mean, I spoke with chemists and wine economists and critics and sommeliers and all, you know, trying to understand what made for a good wine. And there wasn't really a consensus. So this sent me to the epicenter of bad wine, which a lot of, I guess, more what a lot of connoisseurs would consider bad wine, this kind of mass market wine factory that's making a lot of the wines that most of us drink most of the time. And what I think is remarkable is you think about these flavor scientists who design, you know, new hamburger mashups for McDonald's or Taco Bell. And in fact, the way that they're making wine is not so different, right? Sensory scientists who bring in people, do consumer tasting panels, and then let's say people decide that they like cherry cola aromas in a wine, that can be arranged. Maybe they like purple colors in their wine, that can happen too. So when we think about making wine, it's not just grapes and yeast. There's 62 additives that can go into wine, everything from egg whites and powdered fish bladder to liquid oak tannins and something called mega purple. And these are used oftentimes in cheap wines to disguise a multitude of sins and shortcuts. And I think it's worth people being aware of that because, you know, winemakers don't have to list the ingredients that go into a bottle of wine. And what I would say is that there is a difference. You know, to me, there is a correlation between price and quality, but it begins to fall apart around, you know, $80 a bottle or so. So to me, you know, the difference between a $10 and a $20 bottle of wine, that $10 is buying you a whole lot in terms of the quality with which it was made, the, you know, interesting nuance happening in that bottle. And the difference between a $100 and $110 bottle of wine, less so. You know, beyond $80, $100, you're not just paying for the quality of the wine, you're paying for the scarcity of that bottle, the fact that maybe there's only a couple left in the world, you know, that someone has spent all this time to hold on to it while it ages. And so I think that there's, you know, it depends what your budget is. But if your budget is, you know, $15, $20 a bottle, you can still drink really well. I would just suggest that you look beyond what are known as the gimme wines. So a lot of wine lists have what sommeliers call gimme wines because people say, give it to me, I don't care how much it costs. And these tend to be the real brand name, Cabernet Sauvignon from California, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, the instantly recognizable things. And if you want the best shot at drinking great value wines, I tend to think you have a better opportunity by going to those hidden gems, you know, the wine region you've never heard of from the grape you can't pronounce. If you can, if you can splurge, that's your prerogative, but you don't have to be, you know, everyone has a budget, and I think that when you're picking out a wine, the best thing you can do is to be very clear with the person at the wine store or the family at the restaurant and just say, here's what I want to spend, here are the flavors I like, go forth.
We are talking with the author of Cork Dork. Bianca Bosker is our guest. She's a reporter who immersed herself in the world of wine. She became a certified sommelier. We welcome your questions, your experiences with wine. We welcome your favorite types of wine. Do you know your wines, or do you have questions about them? Do you have a favorite Wisconsin wine? What is it and why? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
Take the cork from the bottle of the warm red wine and fill my glass up again.
So do you like the warm red wines, or do you prefer something else? Why do you like what you like? Do you want to learn more about wine? We have the guest for you. She knows a lot about wine. She is a cork dork. She became a certified sommelier. She is Bianca Bosker, author of Cork Dork. Our number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, we just heard George Jones there talking about taking the cork out of the bottle. We have Gary on Facebook who says, why in the world would anyone buy a bottle of wine that has a cork in it when the twist-off tops are so much more convenient? Now, he's being kind of kind of a goof, but it's an interesting question. I'm noticing more and more, actually, wines that used to have corks now having twist-off caps. How is a bottle of wine perceived? Is a twist-off cap a cheap, bad wine? Do you have to have a cork to be a good wine?
Not at all, no. I think that there's definitely a misconception. I find sometimes that a friend of mine, when I'll bring over a twist-off, get a little insulted, and they shouldn't by any means. You know, part of the advantage to using a twist-off is that you don't risk what's called cork taint. So when people talk about a wine being corked, it basically means there's a little chemical that was in the cork, which is a type of wood, that essentially kind of killed the wine. It makes it smell like wet cardboard. And so part of the advantage of the screw top is you don't risk that cork taint. But another element is for a lot of wines, they're delicious, but they're not going to age for a super long period of time. We're not going to, you know, they're meant to be drunk now. I mean, rosé, for example, it's the summertime, and in general, rosé is wine that you should drink as quickly as possible. Not just because it's delicious, but that you want to drink it when it's fresh, it's young, that's what it's designed to do. And so you don't, there's some argument that a cork can better allow for the aging of a wine, but if the wine isn't meant to be aged, it doesn't really matter. So screw top away if that's your preference. And there's all other kinds of enclosures, I should add. I would say canned wines are now having a moment. I wouldn't suggest that these are things that you necessarily want to put away in your cellar. But look, to me, one of the best parts of wine is that it can bring people together. And I think there are moments where you have that incredible bottle that just steals the show. And then there's moments where you're having a picnic and, the cans aren't going to get broken, and you don't have to remember glasses.
Let's go to another call. Guillermo in Mequon is with us. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
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 I have a quick comment to make. with respect to the question that was raised a few minutes ago on the choice of kosher wines, I do agree with you that I have been absolutely marveled at some of the qualities of some of the wines from the volcanic area of Israel, but also by the fact that I was raised in South America in the presence of extraordinary good Merlots and Cabernets. I wanted to pass to the audience the message that you can find, in my opinion, very, very good quality wines at a very affordable price that are bottled in Argentina and Chile. And for those of us who were raised with those wines and are accustomed to the smells of oak in the wine, it's almost like an additional bit of pleasure. And also the surprise is that they are generally very affordable and very, very good drinking wines. And that's the comment that I had.
Well, what do you say to that, Bianca?
Absolutely. And I think that there's some fantastic values that you can find as well in those regions. And there's a real diversity of styles. I mean, there's a Chilean wine called Clos de Fou that is just knocks it out of the park. I think that it's very elegant. It's, you know, Pinot Noir. It's you know, and it's a just it's a deal. It's a steal.
Thank you, Guillermo. Nikki in East Troy is with us now. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Excellent program, in my opinion. My comment: if you've ever heard of Rodney Strong, it's a white wine, a Chardonnay. That one actually happens to be my favorite. It's the one that I've stuck with, especially when it comes to pairing it with a meal. I make my own salmon, and I'll do a glaze over it with, you know, like an asparagus with it. And I find myself actually finishing the whole bottle with my meal because it's not a bitter wine, and that's why I'm not really a fan of red wine. I haven't found one that I've been able to actually enjoy without it being bitter or too sweet. I like it right in the middle. And it's very, for the Rodney Strong, it's very refreshing and very crisp.
Thank you.
Yeah,
very much, Nikki.
Yeah, I not only do I know it, I actually was there for a sommelier competition. So I weaseled my way into being a judge at this event called Top Somm, which was, grueling like you would not believe. There's sommeliers are getting judged on their theory skills. Can they memorize, you know, minutia about wine? It's blind tasting, it's service, and the senior most somms, let's just say, I think they take a sort of perverse pleasure in hazing the up and comers.
Mm-hmm. Well, so
but that's great. That's fantastic. And so you drink it with is it Chardonnay and salmon? Is that right?
Side. Salmon. Yep. Anything with fish, it goes really good with the fish. Maybe even a pork as well. Some people pair more red wines, like a Merlot or a Pinot with that. I've tried certain ones. I'm still trying to taste and find my red wine that I actually like to go with beef.
Yeah. I was wondering, often we hear these rules of, you know, the white wine with the fish and the red wine with the meat. Is that still the way to go?
No. Rules are meant to be broken.
Right.
I think that there's, the kind of enigmatic, riddle-like rule of wine tasting is that opposites attract but likes complement, which is as confusing as it sounds. So, if you think about eating kind of fatty foods, you know, like maybe bratwurst or something, you know, that actually goes really well with a wine that is very high acid. It's that complement between something, you know, the opposites attract.
So pair our brats with a wine. What should we have with our brats?
Yeah. and then there's the likes complementing. So sweet food tends to be better with wines that are a little sweet. But what I would say is, I actually do this series on Instagram. It's called Pair Devil. And the whole idea is pairing wines with the everyday food that we actually eat. So, you know, everything from hoagies to hot dogs to takeout Thai food. And the idea is, I think that you have to experiment. A big part of figuring out wine pairing is to understand what you like. And there can be really, just the other day I had some leftover green curry and this crazy wine from the Jura that's nutty and weird. And my God, it was fantastic. And I will say that if you ever want to, though, just try and drink well while using the fewest number of brain cells, think about drinking wines from the same place as the food. So if you're eating Italian food, try an Italian wine, or German food, German wine.
So that Riesling might go well with the brat, too?
Oh, for sure. Think about what they're eating in Germany. It's part of if you're making wine in Germany and you're sitting down to bratwurst at dinner, I think over those decades you're going to decide that, yeah, maybe you'll make something that's delicious with whatever you're having on a daily basis. So it makes sense. And then sparkling wine. I think we think of sparkling wine as only being for special occasions, but it can make occasions special, and it goes well with a shocking number of foods. Everything from, oysters to beef.
Sure. Jeremy emails, do your some friends tend to poo-poo Midwestern wines, or are some starting to explore? Have you ever heard of or tasted a semi-dry La Crescent wine? La Crescent is apparently a cold, hardy grape cultivar that produces a white wine. It originated in 1988 between two grapes from a breeding program in Osceola, Wisconsin. So anyway, though, if you don't, have you heard of the La Crescent wine? But also, do you and other others poo-poo Midwestern wines?
Not at all. I mean, I think that I certainly don't. I think the good sommeliers don't either. I have to say, I love driving cross-country, and so one of the big joys for me, is as I'm driving cross-country, is to try wines from the places you wouldn't expect. Texas, you know, make some good wine. I mean, I remember even being in South Dakota and having good wine. New Mexico makes stunning sparkling wines. New York is starting to get it. New Jersey. And I have to say, I haven't had this particular Wisconsin wine, but I would love to try it. I mean, I'm so curious. And I think it sounds like this is a different grape variety, which is even more exciting because I think, the sort of name brand celebrity grapes, Cabernet Sauvignon, for example, those get planted a lot of places around the world because they're familiar to wine drinkers, but they don't always necessarily do the best in every different climate. And so I think it's very exciting to hear that there's some experimentation going on. If he wants to give me some advice on how to track these bottles down, I would love it.
Chuck on Facebook wants to hear about non-grape wines like apple or blackberry, cranberry, dandelions. We also have sweet cherry wine in Door County, Wisconsin. He says, I get the impression that many people in the wine business look down on such wines, especially the sweet wines. So, Bianca, is Chuck right?
So I think that there is, the wine world has a reputation for snobbery, and it's not completely undeserved. And I think that there can be a tendency. So just as an example, first of all, sweet wines have sort of fallen out of favor recently, and yet for long periods of history, they were the most valuable and celebrated wines. I mean, when the Titanic went down, its cellar was full of sweet wines. They were the creme de la creme. And I will say that I think that too often the wine world focuses on telling people what to taste instead of showing them how to taste. And to me, the latter is the foundation for a much more productive and healthy and sustainable relationship with wine, whether it's fruit wine, dandelion or cherry or grape. And so that was for me part of the goal of this whole journey and of the book, but I think that that's the starting point, is to figure out, what you like, but that also requires having the tools to understand it. I'm dying. Another one, dandelion wine. I mean, this whole hour has made me thirsty, and it's a little early to start with dandelion wine, but.
Well, I wish we had more time. Do you have a 30-second takeaway from your experience exploring the world of wine for our listeners?
Well, I think that, to me, wine is really an entry point into a broader perspective about how we can better savor the richness of life. So it may start with a glass of wine, but it certainly doesn't end there. And it's exciting. It's messy. It's weird. It's obsessive. There's a whole lot more going on than meets the eye.
And I am looking forward to my homework. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bianca Bosker is the author of Cork Dork. Thanks to Brianne Shasso for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.